autopsy. While his colleague's callback rate is still within reasonable bounds, Orwig said, there is no doubt that the consequences of missing a malignant lesion and being sued cause him to think in a different way. Dr. Potchin published a paper analyzing medical decision-making and concluded that what most influenced clinical choices was the last bad experience. Potchin's conclusion mirrors the availability error, which Cross-Carry and Redlmeyer highlighted earlier. What is most available in your mind strongly colors your thinking about a new case that has some similarities, but it can cause you to ignore important differences and come to an incorrect diagnosis. Imaging the body using X-rays began at the end of the 19th century. Over the ensuing years, advances in technology such as the CT scan and the MRI scan have greatly enhanced a radiologist's ability to visualize our anatomy, but they pose new cognitive challenges. As we saw earlier, a chest X-ray shows a single static view of the thorax along with the heart, lungs, bones, soft tissues, and mediastinum, the area of the chest that includes the aorta. The chest X-ray, again, is performed with a patient in two positions, so that two images are generated, one with a view of the front of the chest, another of the side. When CT scans were first developed, they contained dozens of images. The first MRI scans produced hundreds. When the images from these scans were presented on a film, they averaged 12 per film. This was termed a tile display. Another way to view the images from these scans was one after another on a monitor, called a cinemode, referring to the experience of viewing a movie. A landmark study compared tile with cine viewing of CT images of the chest, specifically the detection of lung nodules. These nodules are small, solid masses in the lungs that can be benign, such as after an infection, or malignant, indicating a lung cancer, or a metastasis to the lungs. Radiologists were much more successful in detecting lung nodules using the cinemode than the tile display. They were also more accurate in identifying artifacts, such as blood vessels in the lungs, that can sometimes resemble a nodule if viewed in a certain plane. The researchers noted that moving images created a novel cognitive cue, particularly with smaller nodules. They seemed to pop out on the cine display, and thus more frequently caught the eye of the radiologist. Throughout the 1990s, cine viewing became the preferred image display mode, allowing more efficient evaluation of scans that contained hundreds of images. But as refinements were made in CT scanning, particularly rapid imaging over large parts of the body that allowed for the visualization of multiple organs and vessels simultaneously, radiologists were presented with a dilemma. There could be 1,000 or more images with many tissues moving at once before the radiologist's gaze. As Dr. Herbert Kressel, the Stoneman Professor of Radiology at Harvard and a specialist in abdominal imaging, recently told me, over an average weekend in a busy emergency department, a radiologist may have to read 150 CT scans. It's impossible for him to look at 150,000 or more images. It is not only in the ER that scans have become routine. Between 1998 and 2002, the number of CT studies in the United States increased by 59%, MRI by 51%, and ultrasound by 30%, during traditional work hours, and each increased by 15% during on-call off hours. Survey studies show that with this increased workload, radiologists reported more symptoms of blurred vision, eye strain, difficulty focusing, and headache. Elizabeth Krupinski of the University of Arizona pointed out in a recent publication that the huge amount of imaging data generated has the high potential for fatigue, discontent, and possibly increased error rates. Kressel extends this concern to the naive reliance on high-tech imaging by busy clinicians. Patients are sometimes sent for studies without a detailed clinical history. Some doctors scribble rule-out pathology on the referral slip. Others can be too directive, or show a poor understanding of how the newer CT and MRI scans work. For example, Kressel told me, recently a woman had been sent for an imaging study with the request, rule out pulmonary embolus. Pulmonary embolus is a life-threatening condition when a clot, often from the legs, breaks off and lodges in the pulmonary artery. We performed the study and timed the images when the contrast material would be filling the pulmonary vessels, Kressel told me. The study showed nothing to suggest a pulmonary embolus, since there was no blunting or obstruction of the contrast material in the pulmonary arteries. A few days later, the reason for the woman's chest pain and difficulty breathing became apparent. She had a tear in her aorta. We could have detected this tear by timing the images on the scan to follow the contrast material through the aorta, Kressel said. The shape of the aorta was not distorted, so the tear was not visualized in the absence of contrast material that would enter the torn part of the wall. The old idea, based on a static study, that an image is an image is an image, is obsolete now with technology that is dynamic, that can show us active changes in blood flow and other aspects of physiology, Kressel said. How you use the machine translates into what you get to see. The problem with applying a methodical and rigorous approach to every image, Kressel said, is that with a CT scan or an MRI, there is just so much data. There may be more than 1,000 images per CT scan or per MRI, so that a single radiologist's entire day could well be occupied with looking at just one of these studies. The solution, in part, Kressel said, is to go organ by organ. In his field, abdominal radiology, he will rigorously view the liver, then the kidneys, then the spleen, and so on. Kressel's strategy, like other radiologists who specialize in MRI, is to analyze primarily the data-rich sequences, those segments of the study that can provide the most information, then arrive at a tentative list of possible diagnoses, and selectively look at other images to find data that support or contradict the possibilities. Sometimes the technology itself sabotages this careful approach. The tracker ball, equivalent to a mouse on a computer, can accelerate rapidly the speed of the images flashing before the radiologist's eyes with small increases in pressure from his fingers. This means that the images may speed up without the radiologist being aware of it. You may not get each image coming at 3 per second, Kressel said. You go to an emergency room, where a radiologist is working under an incredible load, and you watch him go through a CT scan case, and you will see he is flying through it. Kressel has seen how radiologists press on the tracker ball, consciously or subconsciously, in an effort to get through the 1,000 or so images. With your hand on a tracker ball, you can literally skip 3 or 4 images and not even realize it. This is because while you are looking at images in 2 dimensions, your mind is working to integrate the 3-dimensional space that you are moving through. When Kressel supervises residents, I drive them nuts. I force them to slow down so they have to see each image. There should be no shortcuts, either intended or subliminal. After decades of looking at images, Kressel's eye has become so acute that he can pick up subtle differences in contour of a structure in the abdomen, even with a rapid look, he said, which a resident cannot do. For example, there may be a lymph node near the pancreas that is observable in a single image on a scan, and the resident doesn't see it. Identifying this lymph node could be clinically meaningful in assessing whether a cancer of the pancreas had spread beyond the organ, a critical piece of information in its treatment and prognosis. So I will go through the case and force him to go back and show him how he missed it. In some ways, we are victims of our own success, Dennis Orwig said. We have so many excellent imaging techniques. Some doctors hardly examine patients or take histories anymore. They just order scans and say to the radiologist, "Give me the diagnosis." In fact, the week we spoke, there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about whether the stethoscope had become a vestige of a bygone era, since cardiac imaging techniques were so advanced that the findings cardiologists traditionally make by listening had been rendered moot. And when clinicians order sophisticated scans, Orwig continued, they expect a definitive answer back. They don't want to hear a radiologist's description of a constellation of observations. They want one diagnosis. There is tremendous pressure on us to come to a conclusion, Orwig said. And we have to resist that because sometimes you can't make an exact diagnosis. The best you can do is to describe what you see. A seasoned radiologist also learns not to give in when a clinician demands a discrete diagnosis. Sometimes, Orwig allowed, you can say, this is diverticulitis. It's 99% certain, and the clinician then can feel comfortable and go ahead and treat the patient with antibiotics. And that 1% may be a perforated colon cancer. But then there are patients who undergo CT scans, and the best you can say is that there is a complex inflammatory process in the pelvis of this gentleman. Many clinicians don't like to hear that. They think that the radiologist is waffling. But what the radiologist is doing is showing the doctor his thinking, sharing with him the most that can be said based on his expert observations. Just as a clinician needs to choose his words carefully in communicating with patients, he must tailor the language of his request to a radiologist. There is this notion that the clinician wants to keep the radiologist honest, so he doesn't tell him anything specific, Kressel noted. In my field, you will get a referral that says, patient with abdominal pain. But without more specific history, you reduce the kind of clinical cues that are so important and actually make it much more difficult to assess the images. I always thought this was maximally stupid, Kressel said. Why would you want to tie someone's arm behind his back? Not only can this hamper perception and cognition, as Potchin's studies show, but, as Kressel elaborated, it can also affect technique and lead to errors. With the new multi-detector CT scans, very large volumes of tissue are scanned in a short time. So, for the best results, the settings on the machine have to be adjusted to take into account the patient's clinical history. If the clinician doesn't give us a full history, just the one question in his mind, then we will technically tailor the exam to that one question, like, is there pulmonary embolus, and risk missing something else that is important. It is not only the clinician's language that can be misleading. Different radiologists use different terms to describe what they see. People usually don't think about radiologists in terms of nuances of communication, Kressel said. When you think of a doctor speaking, you imagine a clinician at the bedside explaining something to a patient. But radiologists become very impassioned about the words they use in their reports. And, of course, the language used reflects your type of thinking. Moreover, there is no agreement about different terms. No uniform structured approach to communicating findings. This is especially true with the more advanced CT and MRI scanners. Even if different radiologists see the same thing on an image, just from the way they describe it, there are nuances and ambiguities communicated by the terms. Kressel referred again to the woman who was evaluated for a possible pulmonary embolus. The radiologist reported that the aorta was not enlarged. That term, not enlarged, can be taken in many different ways. First, it doesn't mean that the radiologist saw the interior of the vessel. He is just making a descriptive statement. And not enlarged is not the same as saying that the vessel is normal, although many clinicians would take that as the meaning of the radiologist's phrase. Because different terms mean different things to different doctors, a single term can guide thinking in different directions. My hospital recently created a website called Patient Site in response to patients' desire for access to their own medical records. All the lab tests and radiology reports are ready for viewing as soon as they are generated. This provides an opportunity for patient and doctor to sit together and go over the results. Reading the language in these reports can be trying, mostly, of course, for patients, so the clinician should point out the radiologist's words that signal a level of uncertainty. The radiologist may have said the area behind the uterus was not well visualized by the scan, or the thickening of the wall of the bowel was not diagnostic for a tumor and could also represent inflammation. This should prompt the clinician to explain to his patient why he needs to revisit the history, perform a more comprehensive physical examination, or order further tests to define the problem. Communicating this uncertainty poses a challenge. Recently, Orwig viewed a mammogram with a pattern of calcium deposits that are classically diagnosed as benign. But the woman's previous mammogram showed no calcium deposits. He debated with his colleagues about whether to biopsy the breast and came down on the side of biopsy. Orwig went out to speak with the woman whose mammogram showed the new calcium deposits. "I want to apologize in advance," he said. "I think that what we found is benign, but I am going to recommend that it be biopsied." He paused. "I know this will cause you great anxiety, so let me explain my reasoning. What we found on your mammogram reaches the threshold to make this recommendation because it's new. It wasn't present on your prior study. Nonetheless, I am fairly certain that it will turn out to be fine, but we should go ahead to be complete." It turned out there was a high-grade invasive cancer in the woman's breast, which would be removed by lumpectomy followed by radiation treatment. Orwig suggested that the case be shown at the quality assurance conferences, where the radiologists review their choices and try to refine their skills to avoid future errors. One colleague said to me, "If we show this case, given this pattern of calcium deposits, then we are going to have women lining up to the end of the block for biopsies. What good is it going to do? We show this case, people are going to freak out, because then they feel they have to biopsy every patient who has this kind of calcification. We should show cases that will help us because they have very specific findings." Orwig agreed with his colleague that, based only on the pattern of calcium deposits, there was no teaching lesson per se, but he believed the key point was changing one's mind based on a previous mammogram. More broadly, he felt that sometimes a teaching point is made by showing the exception to the rule, and emphasizing that there is this gray zone in radiology, particularly in mammography, where judgment comes into play and specific aspects of a case, like the new appearance of calcium deposits, that would otherwise be ignored as benign, should be a cause for concern. Orwig's colleague was afraid that discussing the case would spark an outbreak of availability errors, the same kinds of errors we saw in the emergency room earlier. A sharp bias in thinking based on a striking, unusual event that recently occurred and becomes prominent in the doctor's mind. Yet, as Orwig argued, not sharing the case could cause colleagues to miss what might be a lethal malignancy. The struggle is to find a middle ground, to be aware of the availability fallacy while recognizing that certain patterns may not conform to the prototype. It is a matter of juggling seemingly contradictory bits of data simultaneously in one's mind, and then seeking other information to make a decision, one way or another. This juggling and this kind of decision-making marks the expert physician, at the bedside or in a darkened radiology suite. Orwig thinks about this woman's case often when he is reading mammograms. When he sees a similar pattern of clustered calcium deposits, not only does he check the prior mammogram to see if they were present then, he also checks studies from earlier years to see when the deposits were first noted. Orwig realizes that he could begin to overread mammograms, lowering his threshold to such an extent that he begins recommending unnecessary biopsies. He still is trying to find that middle ground. Dr. Harold Kundell of the University of Pennsylvania has studied the physiology of image perception by tracking the eye movements of his fellow radiologists. The doctor sits with an apparatus on his head that resembles a bicycle rider's helmet. The apparatus has several parts, including a visor and a miniature video camera. As a doctor examines a series of images, a beam of invisible infrared light is trained on his eye. The camera, trained on his pupil, determines where he is directing his gaze by tracking the infrared beam's reflection. In some of Kundell's studies, a radiologist looked at chest X-rays where there were small lung nodules, each measuring between a half centimeter and 1 centimeter, or about a quarter to half an inch long. Such nodules are important to detect, since they can represent an early cancer or a serious infection like tuberculosis or fungus. In about 20% of the cases, the eyes did not focus at all on the nodules. In the remaining 80%, the gaze was directed toward the nodule, but in half of these cases, the nodule simply was not perceived. The brain makes a covert decision, Kundell explained. Below the level of consciousness, the mind decides that the image is not important, not worth bringing up to the level of conscious recognition. The radiologists, whose eyes dwelled on the nodule for some 2 to 3 seconds, were more likely to consciously recognize it. Recognition would be enhanced if there was sharp contrast between the nodule and the surrounding lung, the contrast between white for a solid mass and black for air. Recognition was also enhanced if the nodule had a clear border rather than a blurry edge. Earlier studies tracking eye gaze done at the University of Iowa showed that search satisfaction was a common error among radiologists. In follow-up studies, Kundell's team showed that in some cases the gaze did fix on a second abnormality, but it was not recognized. For example, a patient with pneumonia might have a small cancer in the scapula, the wing bone. But the radiologist reported only the pneumonia in the lung, even though the apparatus revealed that his eyes had passed over the tumor in the bone. His mind had already snapped closed after identifying the pneumonia and would not consciously accept other findings. It comes down to what your preconceived notions of the image are, which I classify as bias, Kundell explained. Echoing a maxim of Merrill Sossman of Brigham Hospital, Kundell said, "You see what you want to see." The expert, though, having learned about bias and search satisfaction, consciously tries to keep his mind open so that he sees beyond his preconceptions. He is helped in this effort by how the clinical history is framed, by the cues provided in the language of the clinician, and by adhering to the kind of systematic deconstruction of the image that Dennis Orwig follows in his dictated reports. Given the difficulties in perception and cognition that Kundell and other researchers have reported, could computers replace radiologists, or at least lower their error rates? One computer-aided diagnostic system was approved in 2006 by the Food and Drug Administration for identifying lung nodules on chest X-rays. Other systems are being studied, including those for mammograms. The pivotal clinical trial on malignant lung nodules that led to the FDA approval involved 15 radiologists who were asked to note their level of suspicion that a chest X-ray contained cancer. They used a scoring system of 1 to 100, and they were to mark the location that caused their suspicion. 80 cancer cases and 160 cancer-free cases were in the study. Each radiologist interpreted these 240 cases 3 times, 2 times separated by 1 to 4 months without computer assistance, and then, immediately after the second interpretation, with computer assistance. Computer assistance improved detection of the cancer between 14% and 24%. Depending on its size. But the computer system also caused radiologists to change almost 10% of their correct decisions, identifying the cancer, to incorrect diagnoses, stating that it was unimportant or benign. Of the 15 radiologists in the clinical trial, no two had identical results in evaluating the 80 cancer cases and 160 cancer-free cases. All but 25% of the cancers were identified by all 15 radiologists. But the difficult-to-diagnose cancers were found by only 4 of the radiologists. No radiologist identified all 80 of the cancers correctly. One unwelcome effect of computer-assisted detection was that after being prompted by the computer, more radiologists suspected cancer in chest X-rays that came from patients without a malignancy, a false positive reading. This demonstrates the power of technology, particularly computer-based, in shaking the confidence of a specialist in his initial diagnosis. It also demonstrates that machines do not provide perfect solutions to the imperfection of perception and thinking. Perhaps, as radiologists become more accustomed to computer-assisted detection and receive clinical feedback about the risk of becoming overly suspicious about benign findings on a chest X-ray, they will accommodate their thinking to the new technology. In the meantime, as they search for another new middle ground, there will be a trade-off, with more accurate cancer detection, but greater patient anxiety, as more people without cancer are subjected to the emotional upheaval and invasive procedures that follow on false positives. A short drive south from Marin County, across the Golden Gate Bridge, brings you to San Francisco. Perched on Parnassus Heights is the University of California Medical Center and the nearby Moffitt Hospital. Vicki Feldstein is a professor of radiology at UCSF, specializing in ultrasonography. Dr. Dennis Orwig happens to be her husband. Most people are familiar with ultrasound examinations from a pregnancy. The developing baby is imaged, appearing in a two-dimensional representation inside the uterus, a swirl of black and white and gray. Some people consider an ultrasound image to look like a weather map, Feldstein said with a chuckle. It certainly looks like a weather map to me, specifically a snowstorm. The flux of white specks across a black background makes the discrete outlines of organs difficult, if not impossible, for me to make out. Of course, for Feldstein and radiologists who use this technology daily, the images are as familiar as the palms of their hands, and the contrasts of black, white, and gray full of meaning. Given the complexity of the images in ultrasonography, one might think that in this case computers would better assist diagnosis. The computer would provide a quantitative assessment of each structure in the developing fetus. For example, at 20 weeks gestation, an ultrasound is used to measure the ventricles of the fetus, which are the fluid-filled cisterns in the brain. If the length of the ventricle is greater than 10 millimeters, then the fetus is carefully monitored for hydrocephaly, commonly called water on the brain, a disorder of ballooning ventricles that can result in brain damage as well as other developmental abnormalities. But it turns out that the numbers a computer would supply may not reveal what the radiologist wishes to consider. The numbers will help you and raise your level of attention, Feldstein said. But you have to take the whole picture. You have to look at the shape of the ventricles and the associated surrounding tissue. It's not just based on reading the numbers. A normal cerebral ventricle is shaped like a teardrop. The ventricle on an ultrasound is defined by a black central core, which is the fluid, and a white lining, the choroid plexus that produces the fluid. Feldstein recently saw a woman close to her due date. She was near term, she recalled, and the size of the fetus's ventricles was within the numerical limits of normal. But when I looked at it, the shape didn't seem right. The changes in the contour of the teardrop were subtle, but to Feldstein's trained eye, potentially significant. The borders were not smooth, but slightly irregular, and the teardrop was not finely tapered at its apex. Both of these observations could be easily ignored or discounted, particularly since the dimensions were not beyond the accepted limits of health. Feldstein decided that she needed to pursue this, although the clinical consequences of her findings were not immediately clear. At 35 weeks, the question in her mind was, what would the mother do with the information? It was too late to consider terminating the pregnancy, but Feldstein concluded that it was important to know whether her impression, that there was some underlying abnormality in the baby's brain, was correct or not. In part, determining this would help the parents anticipate problems after birth, preparing them emotionally and logistically for raising a child that might be retarded or need special neonatal care. Another dimension that influenced Feldstein's decision-making, the medical legal ramifications. If indeed there was an abnormality in the brain that was not visualized on the ultrasound, but had caused the fetus's ventricles to change their contour, then it would be best to know that before delivery, so no one would suggest that an inept obstetrician had caused trauma that led to brain damage. Feldstein explained to the mother that although her baby's ventricles were within the limits of normal, there also were subtle changes in shape that might bespeak something abnormal in the brain. Feldstein didn't want to unduly frighten the mother, but on the other hand, she felt it was her responsibility to communicate her analysis. The mother decided to undergo MRI scanning, and a cerebral hemorrhage was detected. Bleeding in the fetus's brain had caused the ragged borders of the ventricles and the distortion of the apex of the teardrop. Feldstein's sharp eye had been proven true. The mother delivered her baby with the necessary pediatric neurologists in attendance. Every radiologist I spoke to could immediately recount not only successes like Feldstein's, but also unnerving errors. Herbert Kressel, the imaging specialist at Harvard, told me that recently he had missed seeing an abnormality on an MRI scan, a small but discernible cancer of the liver that was present on several of the images. It was a definite miss. I just didn't see it. And to this day, I really don't know why. He wondered whether he had moved too quickly through the cine presentation, put too much pressure on the tracker ball. But that's a speculation. I just don't know, he said, his voice heavy. People have to understand that there always will be a certain amount of imprecision in imaging and interpretation. Machines cannot replace the doctor's mind, his thinking about what he sees and what he does not see. Attention to language, the words of a referring clinician and the report of the radiologist, can make perception and analysis better. Laymen should understand the inherent limits and potential biases in the beholder's eye, so that when there are important decisions to make, they can ask for another set of expert eyes. Chapter 9. Marketing, Money, and Medical Decisions. I first encountered Karen Delgado in the early 1980s and have followed her career ever since. She carries great sway in her specialty of internal medicine and endocrinology. She sits on national committees that review practice guidelines and set out curricula in physician education. Colleagues look to her for counsel on complicated cases. She is a typically busy clinician with a typically heavy load of patients. One day, not long ago, she had 10 minutes to grab lunch before her clinic began, with 3 new patients and 6 follow-ups. 2 residents would be working with her, but, if anything, these trainees would extend her hours. As Delgado gathered a sheaf of lab reports to take to the clinic, she saw a face out of the corner of her eye and froze. Rick Duggan filled the doorway of her office. There was no escaping him. "I don't know what more I can do, Dr. Delgado," Duggan said. He was a sales representative for a pharmaceutical company that made a testosterone product. "You haven't written a single prescription for my drug." "Not one." He was dressed in a bright blue shirt, gold tie, and sharply cut suit. "Dr. Delgado," he said, his voice taking on a forceful tone, "I want you to write 3 prescriptions a week for the next month." She was dumbstruck. Duggan had been shadowing her for nearly a year, trying to promote his product. He brought boxes of candy to her office 3 times, and when this ploy failed, the candy wasn't very good, Delgado noted, he left invitations to educational dinners at the most expensive restaurants in town. Delgado ignored the invitations, telling herself that if she wanted a good meal, she would have it with her husband on her own tab. What astonished her was that the salesman knew which prescriptions she was writing. "I need you to do this," Duggan pressed. 3 a week for the next month." She stared icily at him, said, "No," put the lab reports in the pocket of her white coat, and walked out of her office. The first patient Delgado saw in clinic was Nick Mancini. Mancini was a solidly built handyman in his early 50s whom she'd first met in the ICU. He had come to the ER complaining of blurred vision and the worst headache of his life. He had hemorrhaged into his brain. Brain scans failed to reveal why he bled, but showed that his pituitary gland was enlarged. So Delgado, an endocrinologist, was one of the specialists called to the ICU on his case. She approached the bedside. She couldn't see his face clearly. The lights had been dimmed because of his blistering headache. But as she shook Mancini's hand and pressed his palm, she made the diagnosis that had eluded all the other doctors. Each had presumably shaken his hand as well, but the thick, doughy flesh signified to Delgado more than the mitt of a handyman. Mancini had acromegaly. This disorder occurs when a tumor causes the pituitary gland to produce too much growth hormone, so the hands and feet grow larger and the facial features become coarser. Located at the base of the brain, the pituitary is called the master gland because it signals other glands in the body, like the thyroid and the adrenal, to make essential hormones. As a pituitary tumor grows, it can rupture its feeding blood vessels, resulting in a cerebral hemorrhage. This is called pituitary apoplexy. The nerves to the eyes run near the pituitary, which accounted for Mancini's blurry vision. If the hemorrhage destroys the pituitary gland, it no longer sends signals to the body, so production of essential hormones stops. The adrenal glands make cortisol, one of the most critical of these hormones. Without it, people are prone to shock, especially under stress, as in surgery, for example. Delgado gave Mancini protective doses of corticosteroids, and he was taken to the OR. The surgery to drain the blood succeeded. He no longer had a functioning pituitary gland, so Delgado prescribed replacement therapy for the missing hormones. In addition to daily doses of thyroxine and corticosteroids, she gave him testosterone, which the pituitary also controls. "Everything okay at home with the kids?" Delgado asked. "Great. My daughter is starting high school next week." Mancini smiled. Delgado nodded. The testosterone preparation she wrote on the prescription pad was not the one made by Duggan's company. The next afternoon, Delgado attended the weekly clinical conference where trainees present cases and the senior endocrinologists comment on them. At the end of the hour, Dr. Bert Foyer approached Delgado. Foyer was in his late 60s, also a prominent member of the staff, active in both clinical care and research. His specialty was testosterone replacement for men with various endocrine disorders. "Good cases today," Foyer said. Delgado agreed. "I ran into Rick Duggan yesterday," Foyer said. "Couldn't you take a few moments with him?" "Bert, I'm really busy." The silence that hung between them finished Delgado's reply. That night at home, over dinner, Delgado's husband, a surgeon at her hospital, surprised her by bringing up Duggan's name. "I don't know if he was looking for me," Delgado's husband said, "but he was in the corridor when I was leaving the O.R. She raised her eyebrow. He introduced himself and said, "Why doesn't your wife like me?" Delgado's husband grinned. I had a few one-liners, but I just shrugged. What's this about? The answer to his question is that some pharmaceutical companies are striving to change the way doctors think about health and disease. In this case, they are medicalizing normal change in aging men. These companies make testosterone products. They want not only to have their drug prescribed instead of the competition's, but to expand the market beyond what medical science dictates. When I spoke with Delgado, she acknowledged that Duggan had targeted her because she was, in marketing parlance, an opinion leader. Working at a prominent teaching hospital, widely recognized as one of the top clinicians in her specialty, supervising the education of the next generation of doctors, readily given the floor at conferences, and having a steady flow of patients, she influenced clinical decision-making in her city and beyond. Duggan had used several classic marketing strategies to get her, in essence, to endorse his brand. The first was gift-giving. Besides the candy and the dinner invitations, he had brought other small gifts, including a calculator, a desk clock, and pens. Delgado left these unopened on her secretary's desk. Duggan, well-dressed and with a practiced seductive manner, then chatted up Delgado's secretary. He knew that without her assent, he stood no chance of pitching Delgado face to face. Delgado politely ignored her secretary's enthusiasm for the sales representative. Once Delgado rejected these approaches, Duggan switched from honey to vinegar. "I was really offended by him," Delgado told me. "He was trying to bully me. It may work with some doctors, but not with me." At dinner, Delgado told her husband how surprised she was that Duggan knew which product she prescribed. Her husband recently had read in a business magazine that pharmaceutical companies contract with drugstores to learn physicians' prescribing patterns. Of course, the companies did not know whom she prescribed the drugs for, but they could obtain a complete list of how many prescriptions she wrote for which products over a designated time period. "It's perfectly legal," Delgado's husband said. "But I don't like it," she replied. She noted that Duggan's company seemed to be using a strategy of escalation, from gifts to confrontation, and then the intervention of her colleague, Dr. Foyer. "I don't really think it's about money for Bert," she said. Although Duggan's company had given him grants for some of his clinical trials of testosterone products. "I think it's simply that he's a believer." For many years, the market for testosterone replacement therapy was relatively small. Doctors treated patients like Nick Mancini, who lacked a functioning pituitary gland, or men born with an extra X chromosome, who have what is called Klinefelter syndrome. Their shrunken testicles didn't produce enough of the hormone. Androgen pills were originally used in replacement therapy, but they often caused liver damage. Then intramuscular injections were tried. These produced a sharp spike of testosterone and a sharp fall, often accompanied by parallel swings in mood, sex drive, and energy. In the late 1980s, a transdermal patch was developed. This allowed safer and steadier dosing, but sometimes the skin became irritated or the patch fell off during exercise. Finally, the hormone was prepared in a form almost any man could conveniently use, a colorless gel that could easily be rubbed on a part of the body, like the shoulders, once a day. This would simplify treatment and expand the potential market, if a group of men could be shown to benefit. A few months before Rick Duggan confronted Dr. Delgado, a two-page ad in Time magazine showed a car's gas gauge and beside it the words, "Fatigued? Depressed mood? Low sex drive? Could be your testosterone is running on empty." The ad went on to explain that, as some men grow old, their testosterone levels decline, and recommended that they consult their doctors about testosterone replacement therapy. At the bottom of the ad, the gas gauge pointed to full. Delgado had seen the ad in Time. It was just one of many. there had been a flurry of similar advertisements in medical journals over the preceding year. One of them called on doctors to identify the men in your practice with low testosterone who may benefit from clinical performance in a packet. The ad featured photographs of robust and happy men placed beside the words improved sexual function, improved mood, and increased bone mineral density. Doctors were told to screen for symptoms of low testosterone and restore normal testosterone levels. One pharmaceutical company, a competitor of Rick Duggan's employer, developed a questionnaire physicians could use to identify aging patients with testosterone levels below normal. These men were said to be experiencing the equivalent of female menopause. Male menopause may be the popular term, but physicians call it andropause or PADAM, for partial androgen deficiency in aging men. Some of the questions were quite specific. An experience of decreased libido, for example, could be related to a decline in the male hormone. Other questions were more vague. A sense of lowered energy or endurance might also indicate a testosterone deficiency, but could also result from many other disorders. And some questions cast an even wider net. Was the man enjoying life less? Was he irritable, less efficient at work, falling asleep after the evening meal? I discussed the ad with Delgado. "Who doesn't sometimes doze off after dinner?" she pointed out. The question, she felt, was simply a way to get doctors to measure an aging man's testosterone levels. With that result in hand, the physician would be obliged to tell the patient, who might then expect the doctor to prescribe the hormone. But was this medicine or marketing? As men age, the response of their testes to signals from the pituitary gland becomes muted. After the age of 40, testosterone levels in a man's bloodstream decline, on average about 1.2% a year. Normal testosterone levels refer to what is normal for men in their 20s. But even the definition of normal for younger men can mislead a doctor who is not expert in endocrinology. Among younger men, testosterone levels can vary markedly over the course of a day. Dr. William Crowley, chief of the Reproductive Endocrinology Unit at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and his associate, Dr. Francis Hayes, are studying the consequences of testosterone deficiency in men. To do so, Crowley told me, they needed a clear definition of normal testosterone levels. So he sampled the blood of healthy men in their 20s every 10 minutes for 24 hours. He also evaluated testicle size, body hair, erectile function, sperm count, muscle mass, bone density, and pituitary function. The men were completely normal by every measure, yet at some time during the day, 15% of them had testosterone levels well below the presumed lower limit of normal. More than 50% below it, in fact. Many men 60 and older often test below this normal range. Does this decline impair their health and functioning to the extent that they need testosterone replacement therapy? In short, does male menopause exist? Karen Delgado and many other internists and endocrinologists worry about what they see as a concerted effort to change how doctors think, to create a clinical disorder by medicalizing normal changes and challenges in life. In this instance, some drug companies were meaning to turn the natural aging process into such a disorder. In other settings, aspects of personality and temperament that deviate from a narrow norm are being labeled as psychological illnesses requiring medication. Of course, there are children and adults with disabling anxiety that cripples their ability to form friendships. But some people who are simply very shy are labeled with social affective disorder and given powerful psychotropic drugs. Others, who work with extraordinary intensity and precision, reluctant to unhinge from a task and worried that they are overlooking an error, are too quickly given the diagnosis of obsessive-compulsive disorder and medicated. In Delgado's field, testosterone is only the latest hormonal elixir in the medicalizing of aging. The growth in prescriptions of estrogen for postmenopausal women can be traced to a bestseller published in the 1960s, Feminine Forever, by Dr. Robert A. Wilson. It turned out that a drug company that made estrogen had paid Dr. Wilson to write the book. Some came to see a supposedly well-reasoned analysis of the biology of female menopause and how its consequences could be remedied with hormone replacement therapy as a marketing manifesto, not an objective clinical treatise. In the past decade or so, marketing directly to the public prompts people like aging men or postmenopausal women to ask their doctor for a drug, even if the drug has not been proven to work for their problem. In the United States, once a drug is approved for sale for a particular purpose, a physician can prescribe it for any clinical condition. The Food and Drug Administration has approved testosterone replacement therapy, using products such as the one Rick Duggan promotes, for patients like Nick Mancini, whose pituitary gland no longer can signal his testes to produce the hormone, or for men with inherited conditions like an extra X chromosome. These are uncommon disorders. The market would number only tens of thousands of patients. But there are nearly 40 million men in the United States over the age of 50. If physicians were to prescribe testosterone to those whose levels are declining, the market could reach billions of dollars. While the FDA forbids drug companies to advertise their products for uses other than those it has approved, they can use other strategies. The ads in Time magazine and medical journals were designed to raise awareness of the condition of testosterone deficiency without naming a specific drug. And, to complement the advertising approach, the drug companies enlisted opinion leaders like Bert Foyer, who may influence their peers or trainees. The freedom to prescribe that the FDA grants doctors can have clinical benefits. In my own field of oncology, drugs approved for a specific cancer, cisplatin for testicular carcinoma, or gemcitabine for pancreatic cancer, turned out to have wider application. Many women with ovarian cancer have received a successful platinum-based treatment like cisplatin, and patients with lung cancer or breast cancer have benefited from gemcitabine. A pharmaceutical company may legally carry out clinical trials of a product for conditions beyond those covered by the initial FDA approval. If the data demonstrate benefit, it can then ask the FDA to widen the approved scope of treatment. The problem arises when the marketing is ahead of the medicine, when the data to support treatment are thin, contradictory, or even negative. Then sales depend on opinion leaders who assert benefit despite the absence of proof. The existence of andropause is unproved. Studies to date on testosterone replacement therapy show no convincing benefits for older men with modestly reduced hormone levels who exhibit the vague symptoms on the questionnaire. Treatment does not significantly increase strength in most muscle groups. Compared to a placebo, it neither boosts libido nor increases energy. A panel convened by the National Institutes of Health concluded that the andropause hypothesis had no scientific basis. Nonetheless, the number of prescriptions for testosterone replacement products continues to rise sharply, reaching far beyond patients with well-defined deficiencies like Nick Mancini. Drug companies, whose primary goal is profit, can drive doctors thinking about what constitutes a malady and how to remedy it. In 1998, I became enamored with a family of new medications because of my own clinical condition. I had suffered a failed spine surgery and was left with chronic arthritic symptoms that made it impossible for me to pursue my favorite sport, distance running. Every time I began to run, I developed muscle spasms in my lumbar region, with shooting pains into my buttocks. Reluctantly, I gave up running, and although I swam and cycled, I never relinquished a sense of loss. Then a colleague, who is a rheumatologist, told me about novel anti-inflammatory medications then under development, the COX-2 inhibitors, which eventually were marketed as Celebrex and Vioxx. I began to investigate these inhibitors and was gripped by the idea that they might restore me to my favorite sport. My enthusiasm was such that I eventually wrote an article for the New Yorker entitled Super Aspirin. The article drew on data that had been recently released from a 6-month-long trial of Celebrex in patients with chronic arthritis. And while my New Yorker piece included some caveats, overall it heralded a paradigm change in the therapy of arthritis. I ended the article with a fantasy that after taking the COX-2 inhibitor, I could lace up my sneakers and run again. So Dr. Foyer's enthusiasm for testosterone was familiar to me, mirrored in my desire to believe that there would be a way to temper, if not reverse, the degenerative changes in my spine. Of course, the story of the COX-2 inhibitors did not end that way. Although some patients clearly benefited from the drugs, their impact, compared with other anti-inflammatory agents, like naproxen and ibuprofen, was not dramatically different. The patients who would most benefit were those who had a history of gastrointestinal bleeding, since the COX-2 inhibitors reduced, but did not eliminate, the side effect of stomach irritation seen with other anti-inflammatory drugs. But the notion that they would have no significant toxicity and would usher in a new era in treatment proved wrong. More rigorous studies showed that there was a small but definite incidence of heart attack and stroke, likely due to changes in blood vessels brought about by the inhibition of the COX-2 enzyme. Another of my dreams about Celebrex and Vioxx was that they might help prevent Alzheimer's disease. One hypothesis was that the damage to the brain was caused by inflammation, so that anti-inflammatory drugs could be useful. My maternal grandfather, Max Sherman, had played an important role in my life when I was growing up. He had worked in the post office, but told us tall tales about his exploits with Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders. Only years later did I realize that he was much too young to have been a Rough Rider, but at the time it caught my imagination and made him into a living part of history and family glory. Not long after the death of my grandmother, my grandfather Max's behavior changed. He became sullen and withdrawn, and at first we thought he was depressed. But then his flat affect gave way to periods of aggression, both verbal and physical. My grandfather was one of the sweetest and gentlest men I have ever met, and this kind of behavior was completely foreign to him and to his family. It turned out that he had Alzheimer's disease and ultimately had to be institutionalized. He died unable to recognize any of us. This specter of Alzheimer's, which haunts so many families, certainly haunts mine. So the notion that a safe drug like a COX-2 inhibitor could be taken daily for decades and not only restore me to my running, but also protect me from the disease that took my grandfather held profound appeal. So profound that it blinded me to critical thinking. As Karen Delgado points out time and again to her patients, it is a common illusion that a drug will arrive that has no toxicity and can, in a near miraculous way, reverse the consequences of aging. As we now know, certain data on COX-2 inhibitors were not initially made public. And while it is understandable to make recommendations based on available information, it is also important to sustain a sense of sobriety and wait for more extensive and long-range assessment before being swept toward a conclusion influenced, in part, by one's personal desires or the seduction of pharmaceutical marketing. For decades, the bulk of the data concerning estrogen therapy for premenopausal women came from the Nurses' Health Study, begun in 1976 and sponsored by Harvard. This was a so-called observational study, meaning that large numbers of nurses reported what drugs they took, what they ate, and what they did during the day. From those reports, researchers drew inferences about what constituted healthy activity and what did not. Although observational studies can yield useful information, they can be misleading. Hidden biases may prevent subjects from reporting certain factors that affect health or disease. A prospective trial including both treatment and a placebo almost always results in more reliable data than an observational study. The Women's Health Initiative, established in 1991, sponsored by the NIH, and involving more than 15,000 women, was a prospective study of hormone replacement therapy and its benefits and risks. The study was to last for 15 years, but was stopped early when an independent board of experts concluded that the hormones, estrogen and progestin, increased the risk of breast cancer in healthy menopausal women. An increased incidence of coronary heart disease, stroke, and pulmonary embolism also was observed among the women taking hormones, compared with those receiving placebo pills. These results cast serious doubt on what had become conventional wisdom since the nurses' health study. But even before the Women's Health Initiative results were released in 2002, other data contradicted the idea that aging women should be given estrogen to prevent heart disease, stroke, and Alzheimer's. It always bothered me that the Framingham study did not show that estrogen protected women against heart disease, Delgado said. The Framingham Heart Study, a large, long-term study of risk factors for atherosclerosis and heart disease, was an outlier, since it seemed to contradict the nurses' health study. It was hanging in my head all those years, Delgado said. But unlike many of her colleagues, she chose not to ignore it. Then the Heart and Estrogen Progestin Replacement Study, HERS, appeared. A drug company sponsored this placebo-controlled trial of estrogen, hoping to show that the hormone helped prevent a second heart attack in older women. The results, however, showed the opposite. Yet, that negative outcome gave most clinicians no pause in prescribing estrogen. The powerful marketing juggernaut seemed to sweep aside any obstacle in its way. In early 2006, a Wall Street Journal headline declared, "In study of women's health, design flaws raise questions." A New York Times headline read, "Rethinking